There are only 13 presidential libraries and museums in the country. This hour, we visit the one located right here in Iowa. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we spend the hour at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. We'll talk with its director, Tom Schwartz. He'll share the role of presidential libraries in light of the recent opening of the George W. Bush Library and Museum in Texas. Then in the second half hour, Tom Schwartz will give us a tour of the exhibit, Iowans and the Civil War, which runs through October 27. Our visit to the Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch starts right after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. The recent opening of the George W. Bush Presidential Library and Museum in Texas has prompted us to visit the Presidential Library and Museum of Iowa's only president, Herbert Hoover, the 31st President of the United States, our chief executive from 1929 to 1933. And at the moment, I'm standing right outside the main door of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, Iowa, with its director, Thomas Schwartz. And thank you for being on our program again.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be on.
Tom, a little bit later on the tour, we want to have you tell us and take us through the current exhibit that opened here at the library, Iowans and the Civil War, the Western Theater, something that commemorates the 150th anniversary of the Civil War with a major exhibit. But shall we go in? Thank you for hosting us today, by the way.
Oh, listen, my pleasure. Yeah, let's go in and take a look.
Some school children, elementary school children here from Cedar Rapids, from an elementary school in Cedar Rapids. A lot of visitors, of course, to the Presidential Library. Many school buses, too.
About half our visitation currently are school groups, predominantly fourth, fifth graders. These libraries are filling a void in providing civic education. So we really become a very good interactive history lesson for them and help to highlight specific curriculum themes, whether it be our presidential troop, which talks about the American Revolution and the creation of the Constitution, whether it be exhibits such as the Civil War, or whether it be people going through our permanent galleries on Herbert Hoover, which get a great lesson about World War I, about food relief, the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression, and then the Cold War. I mean, Hoover dies in October of 1964. He was born in 1864 on August 10th, so that's almost a century of events that we can provide kids and give them. Really, because Hoover is such a central player on the world stage, really a kind of a very hands-on approach to history.
Tom, before we talk a little bit more about the Hoover Presidential Library, I want to have you talk a little bit about presidential libraries as such, and of course the George W. Bush Presidential Library that just opened in Texas. I understand you were there for the opening.
Yes, it's tradition that the library directors of existing presidential libraries attend the opening of new additions into the system. Currently, there are 12. When Bush opened, that made number 13, lucky 13. And so the 12 directors of the existing libraries, beginning with Hoover through Clinton, were there in attendance, and obviously Alan Lowe of Bush 43 didn't need to travel. He was showing off his new baby, and it's a beautiful building. The library system began with Franklin Roosevelt. He designed his own library, built it on land next to his home in Hyde Park, and then turned it over to the government. A Presidential Libraries Act was created allowing living presidents to create their own. That was followed by Harry Truman. Dwight Eisenhower opened in May of 62, and Herbert Hoover being the only living ex-president took advantage of the Library Act, and he opened up the library here in West Branch on his birthday, August 10th of 1962. He was 88 years old. Mm-hmm. Harry Truman joined him. There were about 20,000 people for the event, for the opening, and it was a great day. Since then, presidential libraries have really become more innovative and much more expansive. When John F. Kennedy Library was dedicated, his widow, Jacqueline Kennedy, hired the world-famous architect I.M. Pei to create the library in downtown Boston. And so now it's almost become a bit of a competition for presidents to outdo the previous president. The current Bush Library is 220,000 square feet of space.
What strikes you when you walk in there? What stands out after your visit and after the opening of that library? What is?
Well, it's a beautiful space, and they have a museum that's loaded with interactives. But probably the most powerful exhibit has absolutely no interactives. It's simply two steel beams that are twisted from the wreckage of the Twin Towers with a stone wall, the names of all of the victims of 9/11 etched in stone. And when people go into that gallery, it's immediately silent. Mm. And people behave much the same way as they do with the Vietnam Wall. They find the name of someone they knew, and they just put their hand in a very silent meditation and kind of empathetic bond. It's very hard to leave that gallery without being teary. And then immediately you're kind of into the multimedia kind of interactive displays. Bush is, more than any other presidential library, they have electronic records that no other previous library has. They have 200 million emails. You know, I mean, that's not something that Clinton had or Bush 41. They have things that are born digital, which, again, is something that you didn't have necessarily with Clinton. And so these are kind of brave new world boundaries with archivists and having to figure out how you preserve these things, but also how you catalog them and make them accessible to the public.
If you just joined us with Tom Schwartz, he's the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tom, what do you say we go into the permanent exhibit here for Herbert Hoover? Maybe on our way there, you can tell me a little bit about how is it decided what goes into a presidential library and museum in terms of exhibits and what's left out? That will certainly color that person in history, of course.
The National Archives is responsible for 70,000 square foot of space in all of these presidential libraries, which would include the paper archives, the electronic archives, the artifacts, which often populate the museum space, as well as the education spaces. The foundations usually then are responsible for the other spaces. So in Bush, for example, Bush 43, archives pays for the maintenance of 70,000 square feet of that space. The remainder is the responsibility of the Bush Foundation. Now, the Bush Institute populates a good deal of the rest of that space, and they have their own public policy center and programs, as well as visiting scholars. They also provided an endowment at 20% of the total cost of the construction, which goes to the National Archives and becomes their endowment. So the $250 million that it cost to build the Bush Library, an additional $250 million was raised as an endowment, both for the National Archives space and for the Bush Institute. Mm-hmm. So as you can see, we're rapidly getting to the point where it's not inconceivable that a future presidential library, and it could be President Obama's, could be a billion-dollar undertaking.
How do you ensure, as a historian, that the experience a visitor has is not simply a view of this president, any president, through rose-colored glasses?
Well, typically presidential libraries start out with what is not surprisingly a very favorable image of the president. You want to get across the president's point of view and the legacy. Typically, as libraries mature, what you begin to see is less of the heroic presentation of the president and a more balanced, more nuanced approach, where the president's successes and failures are balanced. However, I don't ever expect presidential libraries to actually be so critical of the occupant that it might actually be seen as opposition. Presidential libraries are really meant to be places where people come, they can explore the past, and we should understand that every museum has a point of view. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're just honest about what it is, people know, and they can then make their judgments accordingly. But more important, I think, is to provide them with information and access to the information, as we do in our reading room for researchers, you know, to use these primary source materials and for people then to draw their own conclusions.
Okay, we're standing here in a small rotunda right at the main entrance of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch with Tom Schwartz, its director. So, Tom, at this point, and let's get a little more specific to this museum, the permanent exhibit. Sort of describe a little bit about what a visitor sees when we go through. Shall we go?
Sure. You know, in this rotunda space, you see the globe, and Hoover is one of those rare presidents that traveled six of the seven continents. The coins show his food relief efforts. The total populations that he reached with his food relief were more than 1.4 billion people. The only other Iowan that comes close to that is Norman Borlaug. And most people, this is an aspect of Hoover that they forget. We start out here in West Branch, and because we have the historic site with the buildings, we leave that interpretation to the Park Service. And what we try to do is to talk more about his time from Stanford University to the end of his life. So we talk about meeting his future wife, Lou Henry, at Stanford, his early efforts in Australia with gold mines, where he began to build his fortune. And then we talk about the time in China, where they get caught up in the Boxer Rebellion. You can see Lou Henry Hoover with a sidearm. Her father wanted a son and had two daughters, but he raised them as kind of to enjoy camp and hunting, the outdoor life. And so Lou has this huge collection of weapons that she collected in their global travels, as well as these beautiful blue and white porcelains. They have several hundred of those that they collected over time, beginning in the Ming Dynasty, moving forward. Lou saw this time, this brief episode when the Boxer Rebellion being under siege, really more as an exciting adventure rather than as fearing for her life. She was fluent in seven languages, including Mandarin, and in many ways was her husband's equal in almost everything. Here we see them in London at the beginning of the war. This is when the American ambassador goes to Hoover. All of these Americans that are stranded need to ride home. Their letters of credit are canceled. And Hoover finds ways to get 120,000 Americans home, gives out over $1 million in loans, and all but 300 are repaid.
There's so many exhibits, we can't possibly capture them in the time that we have, Tom Schwartz. But tell me, you get a lot of, I'm sure, a lot of comments of visitors who've never been here, who are Iowans, and certainly aware that Hoover is Iowa's only president. When you have someone here come through the exhibit and really take it in and look at it, What are the reactions that you get in terms of misconceptions people may have had about Hoover?
People think of Hoover only in terms of the partisan critique as the failed Depression president, you know, kind of the New Deal critique of Hoover. And that is what's repeated typically when you see his name appear in any modern commentary. It's always in a partisan way. What they forget is he was a millionaire by the age of 40. He essentially walked away from his fortune at that age and devoted the next 50 years of his life in public service without taking a penny of compensation. He lived off his fortune. The fact that he did these food relief efforts not only during World War I in feeding Belgium, but in post-World War I in Germany and Poland and Russia and Austria, in the Scandinavian countries, then in World War II with Poland and Finland, post-World War II in Europe, North Africa, Middle East, Asia. You know, Hoover traveled the continent. I mean, he and his wife circumnavigated the globe five times by 1914. I mean, no other president has been so worldly wise, or in his case, he had corporate offices on six of the seven continents. And he dealt with people not in the posh urban areas, though certainly his business sometimes took him there. But typically the ores that he was extracting took him in the worst, most impoverished areas of these countries. He saw poverty close up. And the fact that he had lost both of his parents by the age of nine and was an orphan, it's no wonder that he's saw children and the elderly as the most vulnerable victims in life, and he made sure to provide for their safety throughout his life.
It sounds to me by your description, Tom, that if we had a list, and maybe a list does exist, of the presidents, the top presidents of the United States who are most poorly understood or misunderstood, that President Hoover may be in the top of that list.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting is going back to the opening of the Bush Library, but also the five presidents that were in attendance, you know, Jimmy Carter, his dad, Bill Clinton, and President Obama. All of them are focusing on the very things that Hoover was dealing with in his life. Only the difference is that Hoover was actually there on site. He was dealing with people, feet on the ground, in the midst of war, in the midst of famine, whereas they deal with it in an abstract way in raising money. Now, that's important, but it was funny. I was reading Cicero on the way back, and Cicero talks about those kinds of actions and saying that, you know, the person who actually is there and dealing with need, you know, person to person, is more valuable than those who just contribute money.
I wonder, when you talk about being at the opening of the Bush Presidential Library in Texas and having the five living presidents there for that opening, you were there as well, did it occur to you to say, well, which of these presidents is President Hoover most like?
You know, it's hard to draw those comparisons, simply because Hoover is, I think, unique among our presidents, both in his own life experience and also his career experience. I mean, they're obviously, George W. Bush was a very successful businessman, but he didn't have the same trajectory as Hoover. None of them have the global travels. None of them have, again, before the presidency, during the presidency, and after the presidency, that personal contact with people and with need. And so I doubt that we will have another president like Hoover anytime soon, simply because it was a unique set of circumstances that molded him and molded his experiences. And I doubt that we'll ever get a president from want anytime soon.
Okay, if you just joined us, I'm with Tom Schwartz, the director of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, and we've moved now to a different part of the museum here. We're going to talk about the Civil War exhibit coming up in the second half of the show, but before we do that, tell me, Tom Schwartz, when you are noted as one of the foremost historians of Abraham Lincoln. You were a consultant to the Steven Spielberg film, among other things. When you compare one of our most popular presidents, Abraham Lincoln, with Hoover, what do you see there?
I was very surprised coming here that Herbert Hoover idolized Abraham Lincoln and used Lincoln as his model. When you read Hoover's most famous essay, American Individualism, he quotes Lincoln verbatim and talking about that, the purpose of American government is to provide that open field and fair chance, for all Americans. And he thought it was best done through individual initiative. But, what most people confuse about Hoover, it wasn't simply that laissez-faire individualism, but it was he believed that government served a purpose and that that was to provide that safety net. But that in order to keep individual initiative alive, that it needed to be encouraged. The one of the early exhibits I did when I was here was to compare Lincoln's ideals and, those heroic characteristics we think about, we associate with Lincoln, with Hoover. And you could really find very similar comparisons simply because Hoover thought so much about Lincoln and shared Lincoln's view of the purpose of self-government. So one of the interesting things that Mrs. Hoover did during their time in the White House is she took Lincoln's office, which Theodore Roosevelt had turned into bedrooms for his kids, and reconverted it back into Lincoln's office. And as you will see when we go through this exhibit, there's a print of Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation by Alexander Hay Ritchie based on the Francis Bicknell Carpenter painting in the U.S. Capitol. Herbert Hoover's grandfather bought that print because they were Quakers and they were strong abolitionists and strong supporters of Lincoln. It passed down to Hoover. Hoover took it around the globe with him on his travels. And then when he became president, after Mrs. Hoover reconverted that room, it went above the fireplace that's pictured in the print. And that became Mr. Hoover's preferred workplace.
Well, we need to take a break here. We're talking with Tom Schwartz. He's the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library in West Branch. And we've been talking about the role of presidential museums and libraries in light of the recent opening of the George W. Bush Library in Dallas. And we heard a little bit about President Hoover himself already, but in the next half hour, we'll continue our tour with a look at the museum's exhibit that commemorates the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. It's called Iowans and the Civil War, the Western Theater. We'll have a look at the Civil War Field Hospital they have set up here. Also, the signed copies of the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment. And we'll also talk a little bit about abolitionist John Brown and his Iowa connections. The exhibit is open now through October 27th. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. And we're back with more of this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. And I'm here with the director, Tom Schwartz, of the Library and Museum. And in this half of the show, we want to talk about a new exhibit commemorating the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. With a major exhibit. It's called Iowans and the Civil War, the Western Theater. So, Tom Schwartz, we're going to make our way through this part of the exhibit. There are school groups here enjoying the exhibits. The exhibit focuses on Iowa's unique contribution to the war effort and also looks at John Brown, and I think we'll talk about him a little bit later. But we're starting off in front of a glass case that has what looks like, I would say, a death mask of Abraham Lincoln with hands in bronze. What am I seeing?
What you're seeing is actually a life mask. Lincoln had two of them done. What's interesting to note, though, is that Lincoln gets elected in November of 60. And there was that long period of time because he didn't actually take the oath of office until March 4th. It was during that period of time that you have the Ordinance of Secession. South Carolina decides, and on December 20th, it's not going to wait for Lincoln to issue any orders.
They're already jumping ship before he's inaugurated.
And by the time Lincoln takes that oath of office, seven states had, in the Deep South had already left the Union. He didn't even, I mean, for no cause, other than they feared what he might do. So it was a preemptive strike. They essentially leave the Union. They set up the Confederate States of America. They elect their own president, Jefferson Davis. And the difference is really, as you enter, we show it's over this issue of slavery. Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, gave a cornerstone speech where he said that the Declaration of Independence is based upon the equality of men, mm-hmm. that the Confederate States of America have the exact opposite premise, that it is based on the inequality of men.
Has that idea, when you say that, I'm wondering if it's my memory or my particular education that leads me to this question, or if really this idea of what the causes of the Civil War has evolved in the last few decades. Because in grade school in the 1970s, I came away with certainly the idea that slavery was part of it, but it was really a states' rights issue, that that this union is indivisible, and less of an emphasis on slavery, almost as if Lincoln would have said, if it preserves the Union, we can have slavery.
This notion that the war was caused because of the tariff, because the industrial North and the agrarian South and all of these things that have been offered, ultimately always comes back to the question of slavery. And, you know, slavery is servitude. Slaves were not considered humans. They were considered property. And so when Southerners kept evoking the fact of the Constitution and the Constitution defining them as property, you know, they didn't want to talk about the Declaration. They said these are two different documents. Lincoln always saw the Declaration as informing the Constitution and that they needed to be viewed in tandem. But when you ask states' rights, the right to do what? The right to protect property, which meant the right to protect slaves. And, you know, what's interesting about slavery is that Southerners called slaves property, but in their everyday interactions with them, they treated them as people. And they understood this terrible contradiction. Yeah. And so it was that tension. I mean, there had been kind of this intellectual cul-de-sac that had been created, and Lincoln needed to find a way to get beyond that. And that's what we try to do with this exhibit. When war breaks out, Lincoln immediately doesn't turn it into a war to end slavery. Rather, he knows that there are border states that are vital to the Union effort. Kentucky, for example, very pro-Union, but also had pro-Southern elements in it. And it wasn't really until the end of 61 into 62 that Lincoln is really able to start to transform the war. He realizes it's going to be a long war, it's not going to end anytime quickly, and that he needs to be able to do something to change the dynamic, and that's with the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well you do have, as part of this exhibit, on loan, you have a signed copy of the Emancipation Proclamation. Shall we have a look at that?
Sure.
Okay, and we're standing here. Let's go a little closer. We've got a glass case here, and beneath the glass case, we have, you mentioned earlier, the picture of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. But here, this document is is large. It's 2.5 feet high, maybe 2 feet wide, something like that?
Yes. And when Lincoln issued it, it gave the southern states in rebellion 100 days to put down their arms and to reunite. None of them did. So it meant that all of those areas that were in rebellion, the slaves were proclaimed free. Now, Lincoln could do this under his powers as commander-in-chief, war powers. But it also meant that once the war was over, that Southerners could reassert their property rights. And so that the only way that this could remain in force was with a constitutional amendment. And that's where the 13th Amendment comes in that we'll see later.
Okay.
Now, this was so popular that well over 60 different examples were created to commemorate it from 1863 to 65. This is probably the most visual, and it's colored. The flag is colored. And
so they weren't just printed up. They are not all the same. They are different.
They're different. Mm-hmm. And the ones that were done to raise money for the war effort were frequently sent to Lincoln to sign. And this one was created for Lincoln to sign to raise money for the war effort. Only two others of this particular printing from California exist. There are two from Iowa that are just text, but the text, the shading of the text creates Lincoln's face. One is in English, one is in German. They were come out of a printer in Davenport.
This is really an impressive document to see firsthand here. It's on loan from where?
The Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History, which in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And this document, when it was created, you said there are 60-some of these. Where would it have been posted or presented at the time it was made?
They were sold through vendors, through stores, just as this print of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation was done for a mass audience. So any dry goods store or local vendor would have it. This really symbolized the war effort for people, because once Lincoln issued this proclamation, not only did it show that the war now was a war for union and freedom, but by the end of the war, you had more than 185,000 blacks wearing the Union uniform. 35,000 would shed their blood for the Union. And Lincoln was very strategic in pointing that out to the white North to remind them, especially people who did not think kindly of, doing anything for blacks after the war, that they were willing to shed their blood for your Union. Now, what will you do for them?
We are at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, and we have the good fortune of having the director with us, Tom Schwartz, to show us around a new exhibit about the Civil War that's going to be here through the end of October. It's called Iowans and the Civil War, the Western Theater. So you just told us about the signed copy of the Emancipation Proclamation and how it was so important that by the end of the war, several hundred thousand African-Americans, blacks, were fighting in the Union troops. I see right behind you, you have a picture of a black man here with he's been whipped.
Right. This shows it's a woodcut, but there are actual photographs that these are based upon. Gordon, who was a slave, and his whole back is just scarred with welts of showing whippings. The abolitionist societies in the North, William Lloyd Garrison especially, emphasized the physical brutality of slavery. Actually, the more predominant one was the separation of families, and so the psychological scarring that occurred among blacks. But Gordon does represent this physical brutality of the institution. When the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, he was one of those who was its beneficiary and liberated. And then you see him joining and wearing the Union blue, and he served in the Union Army. So that story of Gordon is replicated again and again. Now keep in mind, the Emancipation Proclamation only applied to those areas in rebellion. So the border states were exempt, as well as if you one of the reasons why the Emancipation Proclamation is probably Lincoln's dullest document, but also it's his most important.
Also on display here, we have the 13th Amendment, which has a lot to do with the Emancipation Proclamation. Tom Schwartz, I wonder if we can move over there and have you tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. As I said before, the Emancipation Proclamation was only a temporary war measure. But when the war would end, it would cease to have validity. So Lincoln began an effort to have a constitutional amendment. Before the war broke out, there was an amendment offered as the 13th Amendment, which would have permanently ensured the survival of slavery in those states which had it. Two states passed it, but it then died once the war began. So the number went, ironically, on that amendment, which would forever end slavery. And what we have, again, is a Senate version. There are 13 of these commemorative 13 amendments that exist. And typically, members of Congress requested that they be made. It's on vellum, which is an animal skin. This one just represents those members of the Senate that voted for it. And it includes Iowa's two senators. James Harlan is there, and James Wilson Grimes is just two signatures below. And it's also signed by Abraham Lincoln. This amendment, it passed the Senate. It failed in the House, and then it was reintroduced. If you saw the movie Lincoln, it talks about the efforts to get that passed in the House. And then it went on to the states. Illinois, to its credit, was the first state to ratify it. The requisite three-quarters of the states didn't come about until December of 65. So Lincoln never lived to see it become law. But he did live to see it leave Congress and go to the states. And he was virtually assured that it would eventually pass the states.
Tom Schwartz, we're coming to near the end of our hour. A couple things I wanted to make sure we got in before we do as we maneuver around the very school children who are here visiting the Presidential Library in West Branch, as we are also being given a tour as well. Right around the corner is you've set up a field hospital, medical care here too. Why did you choose for this exhibit to have medical care in the field be such a focus?
Most people don't realize that the deaths caused by the warfare in the Civil War was not by bullets or bayonets, but was by disease. Of the roughly, now the number is approximately 680,000 deaths that brought about by the war on both sides, were really caused more by things like dysentery. The other thing that I think becomes very contemporary is that because they didn't have antibiotics and they couldn't keep wounds clean, free from infection, that typically they would amputate a limb.
And is that what I'm seeing down there? Sort of
Of the saws, yes. And they literally are pretty gruesome. But this is a typical field kit operation: saws, probes.
These very saws would have taken off limbs.
They would have, and you could pretty much get a saw through an arm or a leg in 15 seconds. So that scene again in Lincoln where they have a wheelbarrow full of legs and arms, that was a very common sight in these field hospitals, and you see the artificial limbs that they had and the crutches. But, you know, again, our veterans coming back from Afghanistan, this is a sight that is reappearing on our streets where people are missing limbs. And the Civil War produced this whole generation of veterans without arms or legs, and they were a very visible sight in the population.
So the survival rate of soldiers who had to have amputations?
It was well over 80%, and that's largely because they would have to cauterize the area, which sealed it from infection. But not having antibiotics and not having enough clean bandages to keep something sterile, amputation was really provided the best chance of survival when you're out in the field.
And finally here, Tom Schwartz, we want to make sure that we mention John Brown. The abolitionist John Brown is a major part of this exhibit about the Civil War and Iowa. For those who don't know, tell us, what is John Brown's connection with Iowa, and why are you featuring it here?
John Brown was popular among the Quaker communities here in West Branch and in Springdale. And in fact, he visited Iowa on several occasions. When he liberated 11 slaves in Missouri, he brought them to Iowa and, in fact, sent them to Canada in a boxcar. So literally, they were on the Above Ground Railroad going to Canada out of West Liberty. He also trained some of his men here. And we have one of the pikes that a local blacksmith in Springdale made for John Brown. These pikes were put on wooden poles, and they were used in the assault at Harper's Ferry. We also have on display a Sharps rifle. These were the rifles that were sent by Minister Beecher out to Kansas, and they were referred to as Beecher Bibles. But what we're trying to do is show John Brown's local connections here, but also how this was fed this national debate and division, which ended up in war, between over the question of slavery. You've got the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 54. You've got the caning of Charles Sumner in the Senate floor in 57. You've got the Dred Scott decision. So you have this sectionalization where the South is becoming kind of isolated. The North is increasing in population. And then the fight is in the territories over whether they will be slave or free. And with the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Missouri Compromise, which everyone thought had settled the question, in fact, by eliminating that compromise, it reopened it. And with Lincoln's election, yes, he was a sectional candidate. He had about 39% of the popular vote, but he had a majority in the Electoral College. And Lincoln's view of this was that he was elected fairly and squarely by the rules. If people didn't like him, they could vote him out. And so he thought that the doctrine of secession was really the essence of anarchy, because it was replacing fairly cast ballots, which eventually became bloody bullets. And this is one aspect of the war that I think gets lost, because once the shots are fired, then everyone gets caught up in the military affairs. What Lincoln thought that the war was about was the viability of self-government.
As a way of finishing up here, I see right behind you, Tom Schwartz, so we could go out with a little music to end this edition of River to River from the Presidential Library in West Branch. I have to believe everyone who grows up in the United States at some point sings this or knows this song. It's called the John Brown Song. Is there any history that goes along with that? Or maybe you'd like to hum it or sing it for us.
Well, John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. His soul's marching on. Now, Julia Ward Howe takes this tune that's very popular, it was a folk tune before this time, and she creates what really becomes the national hymn of the war, the defining hymn of the war, and that is the battle hymn of the Republic. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has truth and faith, the lightning of this terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. So, you know, you've got these popular songs that come out of the war, originally kind of folk songs or spirituals that are given kind of new meaning, which is really kind of this rebirth of union, and a union again made more perfect because we now have given real meaning to this truth of all men are created equal.
Well, I want to thank you very much. It's been such a pleasure to have this personal, this guided tour from the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, Tom Schwartz. Far too many things to digest, to see. We've given a few of some of the highlights here at this exhibit. The exhibit is called Iowans and the Civil War, the Western Theater, through October 27th at the Hoover Library and Museum in West Branch. And thank you for this personal tour, Tom Schwartz.
Thank you. Come back.
and let's have you sing some more when we do. Well, that's it from West Branch. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer in West Branch. Thanks for joining us.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth.